Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Ernestine Lyons, host of Quick to Politic, the podcast, the social commentary show that explores topics ranging from social justice to history, economics, small business, and of course, local and national politics. Thank you for joining me.
You know, to have my family back together and us just to be kicking it. I mean, we're still, you know, dealing with the pandemic in our own way, you know, and trying to push through it. But I'm glad to see that there's a vaccine now. I was a little bit apprehensive at first about it, but to be honest, you know, we need to get back to normal as a society, and we just have to trust the science. And, you know, I would rather, you know, take the chances on maybe, you know, having a little muscle ache with a vaccine than potentially getting coronavirus and suffering from, you know, an illness that I might not be able to cover from, or my mom or my children. So, you know.
Right, right. And I do think that, like,
gave you a lot of answer in that question.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, because it's just like you go out there, and I feel like I've been doing a lot of like, oh, shopping for Christmas. And then now I'm kind of feeling like I want to lay off of the going out to eat. I want to lay off, like, not going out to eat, but like getting carry out. I just kind of want to, because I don't know, like, even today, you know, I've been having like, you know, just weird kind of like, either it's burnout or it's, you know, just kind of, all right, I don't feel right being around people. And then I went nuts today when like a couple walked into Kroger and neither one of them had on a mask, but yet everybody else in the store has on masks. So I'm like,
I mean, the audacity of people, right? It's like, so you think you don't have to, or you think that you're somehow so special that, you know, you couldn't possibly have COVID or be passing it around, or if it's in the air, somehow you're so invincible that you couldn't.
Yeah.
The lack of regard for yourself and other people, I mean, it still appalls me at this point. And I mean, luckily we live in a state that has some pretty strict, you know, mask wearing regulations and gathering regulations. And even with those, we're still seeing people gathering in large numbers. We're still seeing people like the ones that you're describing who feel no responsibility to wear a mask whatsoever. And, you know, I can't imagine what it must be like living in those states where coronavirus doesn't even exist.
Right. Or it's just like, oh, it's a hoax to these, because my friend, she actually, she's a PhD student who is, you know, living in Ohio. And she's like, I just bought a house in Michigan because I need to leave here. And now that she's like wrapping up her PhD, she's like, I can't leave here soon enough.
Yeah.
Because like, it's so weird, because she's like, no one takes this seriously. And, you know, then her partner is at risk because they have like a heart condition. And she's just like, okay, so we are about to get ready to go live. We are recording. And then how it works is like, I record, upload it. And then it's also like the audio is uploaded to the podcast. So people can listen. And I'm going to go ahead and take us live on Facebook.
Nice.
Okay. Okay. We are now live on Facebook. Hello, hello, and welcome. Welcome. Okay, am I on mute? No, I'm not. Welcome to Wendy Caldwell Liddell. And she is just a wonderful, a beautiful soul. And just she does everything. She wears multiple hats. She is an urban planner, a mom, an activist. Tell us a little bit more about yourself as we get into here, and where people can find you out there. And I know you're taking a little social media break, but, you know, if you want to be found in your services, I know you also do contracting. Just let us know how we can, you know, find out more about you.
Yeah, so thank you for having me on the show today, Ernestine. I'm so happy to be here, and I'm glad to connect with you. This has been like a long time coming, I feel like, me and you getting together for a conversation. So I'm glad to be a part of this platform. So yeah, my name's Wendy. I'm 29, native Detroiter, proud West Sider. Shout out to Linwood. I always do that.
Love it. Hey, you really have to rep. And somebody was just like, nobody loves Harper Woods more than you, Ernestine, because I'm just always like, yes, you have to represent.
I know, that's right. Proudly, right?
I didn't know you were only 29.
Yes, 29. I'll be 30. My 30th birthday is next year in April. So I am praying that 2021 brings me a good, happy, healthy 30th. But yeah, you know, born and raised in Detroit, wife and mother of two. I have a 10-year-old boy and a 2-year-old daughter. You know, I've been living in Detroit most of my life, you know, except for the portion where I was like in Lansing getting my degree. But immediately after I got my bachelor's in urban and regional planning, I moved back down to Detroit. And I've been working here as an urban planner slash consultant literally since I got back. You know, urban planning is actually what pushed me into the consulting field. It's, you know, kind of crazy how that whole story happened. But the short of it is, you know, I got a job at a nonprofit on the East Side. Shout out to the East Side Community Network. I always say they gave me my roots over there.
I had no idea you were connected to East Side Community Network. Wow. Okay. And you know what? I was born and raised on the East Side. So like, you know, Mac and St. Clair. So that's like... Yeah, that's where I grew up. And so it was like weird because I was born in Detroit in like my immediate house, you know, that I spent the first like 4 years was on Harding, Mac and Harding, and then Mac and St. Clair, which is like two streets over. So and then, you know, moved to Harper Woods when I was 11.
Okay. Nice. Mm-hmm. So you've been in Harper Woods basically since you were 11. Oh, I see how it makes
sense. Yeah, I grew up in Harper Woods. And I think that, you know, the more I think about it, you know, a lot of Detroit memories are just kind of going back to Detroit. But really, it's like when you're 11 and 12, you're really getting your own sense of identity. So my identity is very Harper Woods. Yeah. And, you know, I think, but still, it's just like, you're still a Detroiter because like whenever I'm anywhere else in the world, you're just like, oh, well, where is that? I'm like, well, Detroit. So
Detroit is such a unique city that if you've ever lived here, you're proud to have lived here, right? And it doesn't matter where you live. I mean, there's so much neighborhood pride that's here. I mean, you say you're a proud, you know, Harper Woods native. I'm proud, you know, Detroit native. I mean, and not even native in your case, but I mean, it's about representing, I think, our culture as a whole here in the metro region.
And right,
I think
it's right. And then it's East Side and West Side. And, you know, East Sider. And then even when you think about it, like when you break it down to the state level, like I can always hear an East Side Michigan accent. So I'm just like, I know you from these. I know you from St. Clair Shores. I can pinpoint it.
But you know, I like I said, I got my bachelor's from MSU, you know, just to circle back and wrap this up. And I got my roots over at ECN. And it's funny that you said you grew up over on MEC. The first job that I had with ECN, it was managing a project called the MEC Avenue Green Thoroughfare or Green Tea. And what we did was, it was like an art installation, biofuel, pennycress growing project. We did a bioswale in the right of way. We did cut flower growing. I mean, there was a lot of activity over there during that time, thanks to a grant from the Kresge Foundation. And we were able to, you know, implement a lot of projects that basically were intended to, you know, build the neighborhood identity over there and improve the community perception. And I really did love that job, and it exposed me to both, you know, what it was like to be both a planner and a consultant. And I mean, from there, my roots kind of just got deeper in both of those fields. So now, you know, as a result of that experience and all of the other places I've been, I mean, you know, I've worked at the city of Detroit. I've worked in the private sector, public sector. I mean, I've pretty much done it all just in this 5 years, which honestly saying that is like, it sounds a little crazy to me so when I think about all of the different spaces that I've been fortunate enough to move through and all the different kinds of people that I've gotten to know, you know, even people like you and even this year, and how that all culminated into the work that I did this year, you know, and the progress we were able to make with Mobilize Detroit. But all in all, you know, I love the work that I do as a planner. I love how it has grown me, you know, as a consultant. And this year with Mobilize Detroit, which I know we'll get into soon, It's one of the reasons why I kind of forced myself to take this social media break, because there was so much that happened in such a short amount of time. And I wanted to take some time to digest it all. So that's sort of this phase that I'm in right now, where I'm digesting and recalibrating and spending time with my family and getting back in touch with myself, and hopefully coming into the new year anew. So.
Right, right. And it's really important to kind of take a step back for mental health, because, you know, mental health is something that's really important to me, because I do have family members and, you know, folks who, you know, have dealt with these things. And I think it becomes heightened over the holidays. So you do have to take that step back. And this is something I've been telling a lot of friends, and I have to tell myself to just kind of step back and then, you know, reassess, to be there for everybody who's dependent on you. And, you know, that's really important, to be able to preserve, you know, your own sanity. And, you know, even though we're all like, oh, I'm strong, I can power through this, I think this has been a particularly hard year. And I don't think you give yourself grace, you know, having navigated through all of this. And now here it is 2021. On the heels of 2021, and we have vaccines, and we have, you know, so many different things, and, you know, all of this, and we're going to get into this later with, you know, the potential of a stimulus that can come and kind of give us a little bit of respite from all of the struggle. But, you know, so that's another thing. Before we jump into some of our main questions, I wanted to ask, like, why urban planning? What is it that really brought you to, you know, that world of wanting to, you know, just kind of create things for cities, and, you know, to change the way that, you know, we interact and how we function? And, you know, what exactly does urban planning really give you as far as, like, an individual contributing to society?
So I love that you asked that question, because I love telling the story. So I actually, when I got to MSU, I was originally a journalism major. I am a very talented writer. I have always been. I mean, my earliest memories were of me writing. Like, I can remember having little books my mom would buy me when I was like 3 and 4 years old, where I would just write. And as I got older, that writing turned into sort of a passion of mine, where I was able to express, you know, things that, you know, I was going through, or things that were happening around me or in my community, and sort of using writing as a tool to really express myself in a lot of different ways. And when I got to MSU, I had a professor in an environmental science course that was like, you know, one of those random courses you got to take to graduate. And, you know, he pulls me to the side, because I used to get really passionate back in college. And I also want to apologize to any of those students I used to argue with down.
No, class. We need that kind of level of passion. Don't ever tone yourself down for, like, you know, we need that. We need that. And, you know, we need your voice and your perspective.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But I used to get so passionate in class. And one day the professor, he pulls me to the side after class, and he goes, "Hey, I think that you would be a really great fit for urban planning. Have you ever heard of it?" And I was like, "I have never heard of that. I'm going to be a journalism major. I'm going to write stories about Detroit. I'm going to tell stories about what's happening in our city." Because I had, you know, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. And so I had been, you know, out of the state, you know, a few times on different trips, you know, and had a chance to explore the world. And I always noticed that when I would go places, you know, the things I would hear about Detroit when I would say I was from Detroit was like, "Well, you don't know Detroit. You know, you don't know anything about what it's like to really be from there." And then at the same time, while I was away at MSU, there was this narrative building around Detroit is like comeback city. But, you know, I'm going home every other week and visiting my family, and I'm like, comeback where? Because they got some cute buildings downtown, right? And so it just fueled me further to want to tell our stories, you know, through journalism. But this professor, he goes, "You know, I really think you should just go talk to an advisor. I mean, you just would be such a good fit for it. I mean, the things that you write about in your papers, the things that you love to talk about in class, I mean, it just seems like it'd be such a good fit for you." So he gives me a business card of a professor, Jong Lim. Miss J, we used to call her, because her name was so hard to say. She's a little short Asian woman. And I mean, I went and met with her one day, and the rest was history. I changed my major immediately. I did so very well in the program. I ended up becoming the president of the Urban and Regional Planning Student Association up until I graduated. I did a ton of fundraising events for the college. I mean, I pretty much just rooted myself. I got tons of internships. I loved, you know, the field so much, and I fell in love with it so much because I said, this is a field where, you know, beyond telling stories, I can actually write policy and change laws and like really navigate these arenas where there are not a lot of Black people, you know, able to really, really impact this realm in a way that provides our communities with some form of, you know, respite. And, you know, I look back on my hometown and I'm thinking, if I become an urban planner, you know, I can go use those skills to do good in Detroit. And that's what I wanted to do. And so, you know, I got my degree, I came back home, and like I said, the rest was history. So.
Right. And that's the thing, like, that's actually how we met. I was on the Harper Woods Planning Commission for several years before joining council. And, you know, it was just always fascinating to me, like, understanding what it takes to really contribute to, you know, a robust economy is understanding how planning and development work. And, you know, it was just a fascinating world for me to kind of have a say in what came where, you know, understanding what form-based code was and bioswales and just kind of looking at, you know, zoning and where is going to be the, you know, just understanding what's going to go where as far as zoning in residential versus commercial. And, you know, it's just a really fascinating world. And, you know, I was really lucky to be a part of that. And I think I did learn quite a lot, you know, just being part of that. And, you know, it's really one of those underestimated fields where, you know, people are like, what exactly do urban planners do? But it's like, they do everything. And I think it's really the lifeline of, you know, what really makes for plans to really actually become action. So and so thank you for like everything that you do in planning and development. And, you know, it's just such a fascinating role.
And I love that you say, you know, what do planners do? They do everything. Like, you know, planners really do. I mean, you can think of planners literally for every field of government that exists, that controls, whether it's the development, the look, the feel, the environment of a city. There is a planner that had their hand in determining ultimately, you know, what you're standing in, you know, whether it's your house, you know, whether it's the building you work in, the park that you're playing in, there's a planner that had a role. You know, I like to think of myself as an equity planner. I'm someone who, you know, no matter who the client is, no matter what the project is, I'm striving to make sure that the people who are most marginalized in that context have their voices brought to the forefront. So I prided myself on being that kind of planner. But yeah, we have transportation planners, housing planners. I mean, you name it, they exist. And our goal, of course, and it doesn't always happen this way, and I know we'll get into it, but our goal is to ensure that there is some sort of social equity in the arrangement of our communities and our neighborhoods. And, you know, that's a part of why I'm here in the field and why I practice it.
Okay. You know, so that actually is going to transition us into one of our first questions, which is, you know, looking at urban planning and historically, you know, urban planning was designed to keep certain places in certain cities segregated. And looking at historical practices like issuing of racialized real estate covenants saying like, oh, if you're, you know, Jewish or Black, you cannot live here. And then redlining. And so now you kind of have, you know, millennial urban planners and, you know, Gen X urban planners who have kind of stepped into the scene, and there's a need to sort of rectify or justify the wrongs of the past that were meant to keep people out. So what are some of your thoughts with, you know, urban planners looking to rectify and eliminate disparities in wealth, housing, and opportunity as far as marginalized peoples?
Yeah, so, I mean, first I'll say, you know, there are a lot of, as you mentioned, the institutional inequities that exist in the planning field. I mean, we all have, you know, talked 1,000 times over about the impact of urban renewal and the decimation of communities like Black Bottom and Paradise Valley in Detroit and very similar Black economic wealth centers in majority Black cities all across this country at the same time, thanks to urban renewal. And I think when we look at the backdrop of that, you know, and the racial covenants that locked Black people out of getting housing in well-to-do neighborhoods, and the FHA policies that prevented Black people from owning, I mean, literally the federal government sanctioned racism against Black people at one point, and all of that, you know, impacted planning to one extent or another. And I think when we look at that backdrop, it is our job, our number one job as planners, to look at that and to feel it, and not just read about it and not just say, oh my God, that happened, but to actually feel that, you know, feel that impact and understand what the consequences of that impact are on the communities that we live in right now. I mean, and when you look at that, then look at that in the context of your job and say, well, what can I do, you know, on this major project or in a year, but what can I do today in the field that is going to make it so that I am being that much more conscious in my decision-making, that makes it so that I am holding my clients and my colleagues that much more accountable for the work that we are doing. And I think that it first starts with acknowledging that the painful history is there, acknowledging the result of that painful history, and then acknowledging the institutional barriers that still exist because of that history. I mean, and when we're talking about Black people being locked out of homeownership, for instance, right? You know, a lot of people don't know this, and Ernestine, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but single family zoning, for instance, is historically a very racist policy. It is a policy that ensures that people who can afford to live in single family homes, which are usually, you know, whiter or richer, or, you know, more well-to-do families, are able to live in those communities without having to interact with poorer people. And single family zoning, because it then excludes out other housing types, those other housing types tend to be those that are more affordable. It tends to be rental housing, housing that usually Black and brown people live in. And so when we look at how single family housing and that sort of zoning impacts our communities today, I mean, the segregation is in the geographic footprints of everywhere in our society. And I think in understanding concepts like that, it is our job to then say, what can we do to start to fill in our communities in a way that makes people start to look at one another, right? That doesn't give us, that no longer gives us permission to decide that we want to live in a neighborhood that has only one housing type and that's it, so that I never have to interact with someone of a lower income class. I mean, the idea in and of itself is actually quite insane, because, you know, studies have shown that when people mingle with other families of other, you know, varying income levels, one, it improves you as a person, like it improves your interpersonal interactions with others, you know, coming from a level, maybe if you're wealthy and you're interacting with people who don't have as much money as you, right? It makes it so that you're a little bit more conscious about who you are as a person. But then for those on the lower end of the financial totem pole, it makes them want to strive for something better. And so there are these amazing trade-offs that you get as a society when you
diversify your perspective. And I think that's the thing. You become enriched by who you know and getting a different perspective, because they say that, like, statistically, when you have, you know, kids who are never exposed to anything new and no one around them is an example of anything successful, then, you know, they aim for the floor and hit it, you know. And it's just like, as opposed to having exposure to things that can set your aspirations a little higher, you know. Yeah. I think that's really important. And you touched on a point here about, you know, the whole single family zoning. And, you know, I know that in urban planning, mixed use development is really, you know, sort of something that people encourage. And that's something you would have seen in the 1930s and 40s, where you have, you know, a storefront and then above are apartments. And, you know, so you have a lot of different things that are happening, as opposed to only retail here, only mall here, 16 lane highway here, and it's not walkable, it's not accessible. And, you know, I think that we as a society, we want to get back to that simpler time where you have that mixed use, where you can have, you know, just different types of things in different areas. And I think that also leads to, you know, a perspective being more broad. You know, you can have, you know, coffee shops that are walkable and you go right down to the grocery store that's, you know, and what's so wrong with, you know, families living in apartments? I think it saves energy, and I'm all about sustainability. You don't need to live in giant houses like we do. too, where in America, everything is so sprawling and wide and people think, well, I need all of this property because I have kids or I want a family. But it's just, when you look at the rest of the world, particularly in like advanced developed nations, you know, you go to Europe or places like that, and people do live in these kind of, you know, homes where the kids are still vibrant. They're still able to grow and learn and be nurtured and be out in nature. So it's just really, I don't know. I think we really have to, you know, take a deep introspective look into what we think we need and, you know, just kind of get back to really learning from each other.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point that you bring up. And to that point, Ernestine, you know, I think in general what we're lacking in our communities, especially in America, is just that diversification that mostly fills up the middle, right? We in planning we call it missing middle housing. So in the context where, and you can go anywhere in this country and you're gonna find that mostly, you know, somewhere between, I would say maybe 70 to 80, maybe even 90% of our neighborhoods are like these major single family zones, right? And it's like, I mean, that by itself, that sort of monopoly on a housing type that we have in our neighborhoods, it is inevitably a destructive one. You know, any society, any community exists best when it is as diversified as possible. And when we think about even those like those large housing types and even, you know, communities that are full of mostly apartments, you know, you're gonna always have extremes because extremes exist, you know, in life. There are gonna be, you know, places where there are only gonna be, you know, huge houses on huge pieces of land. And there are gonna be places where there are only apartment complexes that are packed on top of one another. But those should be the extremes. You know, those should
they really
not
should. And as you see the point, like this is how we get so polarized. And I just wanted to interject for half a second here get a little bit more clarity around single family zoning. And does that just mean one house where a family lives and not like duplexes and, you yes. know, no apartments? So it's just like, you know, in a residential area, you're going to have house after house after house. It doesn't matter, yep. you know, how big or small, it's defined as a single family kind of zoned residential area.
Yes. Yes, okay. It is. Where one family can live on one parcel, basically, that's single family zoning. A lot of how we have a lot of two family, three family, four family flats in Detroit. You know, single family zoning said, we don't want none of that. We want one family per parcel. And basically, you know, if your family can afford to have a parcel of land with a house on it, chances are you've got a little bit of generational wealth. You've got a little bit of money possibly in the bank. And more often than not, that's something that's not a trait of, you know, Black people, just given the history. Most of us do not own a house. And, you know, that is a fact. And again, even looking at those policies, I mean, as a planner, you know, some of the things that I have even learned in recent years working in corporate America, just with, you know, the way that, you know, our planning policies that are so intended to support us actually don't in any sort of way. And how, even though we have so much data that points to these major inequities in the way that we do housing and the way that we shape our neighborhoods, you know, there are a few people that want to actually, you know, be a part of making those changes or want to be on the front, you know, doing those things because of how it could be perceived. You know, I worked in a community, I'm not going to say which one, just recently, you know, did a master plan, and they actually, we did a survey where we surveyed the residents, and this is a majority white community. They have, you know, beautiful water features, beautiful natural areas. It's like semi-rural. The residents liked to think of the community as a rural one, but they really weren't. But they had, you know, sort of that situation you and I were just discussing, where these were large houses on large pieces of land. But when we did the survey, we got tons of responses. I mean, that's one of the toughest, you know, surveys I had ever done, you know, for a community to do a master plan. And over 80% of the respondents said, we don't want any more multifamily housing. We don't want, you know, there are too many renters that have come to this community. We're sick and tired of it. You know, can you please make it so that we have less renters? So then we started looking at the data, right? Because that's my favorite thing to do. My favorite thing to do is to dig up the data and say, well, what is the data say about your community? Let's see, are there really a lot of renters, or are they just packed
in? I know, because statistics will really show you what's really going on. Because people in surveys will be like, I'm going to tell you what I think you want to hear.
Yes. And so I go pull the data in Ernestine. I found that more than 50% of this municipality's residents were renters. More than 50%, right? Guess what? I mean, I just want you to throw me out a number. Guess what percentage of the survey respondents were renters?
Ooh, the survey responders? Mm-hmm. Oh, people like to play high and mighty. So I'm gonna say it's like 65 to 70%.
5% of the survey respondents were renters.
Wait. Okay, so it's the opposite. It was just like, you know, people had all these opinions about renters, but none of them were renters, and they had very much.
Yes. Like, we had a survey done for a master plan and had gathered feedback from hundreds of people, less than 5% of whom were renters in a 50% renter community. And so we said, well, let's pump the brakes. Because we have all of these people who marked off that they were homeowners saying, we don't want any more renters, but we have only gotten 2 survey respondents from renters. So we have to get to the renters and find out how they feel. And what we ended up finding was that most of the renters were in single family housing in the community, because there were not any apartment complex available. And the ones that were basically falling apart because of this municipality. You know, they basically did not even have a rental registration ordinance. They were so against having renters in their communities that they would not even develop an ordinance. And we essentially had to give them that like push to go like, hey, you might need an ordinance. Like, you know, if 50% of your community is renters, you aren't even ensuring that they have, you know, a high quality, you know, standard, you know, of housing or anything, you know, without an ordinance. And sort of we had to push that narrative. But I say all that to say, you know, these attitudes about what our community should look like are still so pervasive. I mean, racism today and planning and in communities, it does not look like the racism of yesterday. It is not racist covenants that say, you know, you can't buy housing in this neighborhood. It is not an FHA policy. It's not the federal government telling you, you know, under Trump, maybe it was a little bit, right? But, you know, in general, it's not the federal government telling you, you know, if Black people own a certain percentage of housing in this neighborhood, we won't, you know, back the loans. It's not that. Instead, it's, you know, we don't want any multifamily housing. We're sick of renters. And it's this.
So it's coded. It's coded. And, you know, that's another thing. I do think that renters sort of get a bad rep when really you've got to think about the fact that, like, maybe it's the landlords that is the problem. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it is going to be that. And it's like, mm-hmm. Are you really truly vetting the people who you are giving your property over to for an extended period of time? Are you really truly taking care of the property the way that it should, you know, because you should have criteria for who you let into this property. And then you should also, you know, be making sure that you're doing right by the communities that you are owning these properties in. So you have a lot of slumlords. And, you know, I like to play devil's advocate when it comes to arguments around, well, we have an increase in renters, and so therefore that's why there's a decline, you know, because I refuse to believe that, you know, every single renter is going to be the worst person and every homeowner is going to be the best person, because I have neighbors who are homeowners and they are just, they'll park their car on the front grass and it's just like, it's terrible. There's arguments and fights. The cops are at their house like every other day. And it's just, you know, but so you have those same kind of situations, you know, with people who are homeowners. So I just refuse to, but it is a very coded kind of thing. And I think people are saying, oh, it's renters, when, you know, that's kind of really meaning something else.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you bring up such an important point about that with homeowners, because I mean, the reality is being a renter doesn't mean that you care less about your community. I mean, I did master planning in a community, a small neighborhood in Detroit last year, where we ended up interviewing renters who had lived in this neighborhood for more than 30 years. More than 30 years, you've been paying rent in this one neighborhood. I mean, and then people who have said, you know, and if I could have, I would have bought the lot next door from the land bank, but they won't let me own it because I'm a renter and my landlord, you know, won't let me buy the house because, you know, she sees, you know, she's out of state, but she sees the stories on the news about the comeback and she wants to sit on her house and wait for it to make money. And it's like, you know, being a renter doesn't mean that you're going to do worse by your neighborhood. I mean, I'm a renter in my community. And if I do say so myself, I'm a pretty awesome one at that. But I think it a function of what causes, you know, renters to get a bad rap, it's a function of two things. One is absolutely the landlords. Well, it's really three things. One, sometimes it's the renters themselves. You know, if we're being honest, there are always a few bad apples in every bunch. You just mentioned the ones we have with homeowners. But more importantly, it is a function of the landlords and policy. Okay, it is those two things.
Number one, because you mentioned a term, rental registration ordinance. And yes. So I know that when you have community benefits ordinances, it's like it's yes. mandated that you have to do X, Y, and Z. So that's something that cities can make sure and municipalities can really force people to be held more accountable and yes. have that minimum standard, you know, for making sure that. You know, and that's the thing, you do have jerks who move into homes who are renters and, you know, they're just not going to care. You know, you do have people like that. You have to acknowledge that that is a thing.
It is a just but, like with home, right? I mean, but again, it's those bad apples in every bunch. And I think to that point that you're mentioning, you know, if we don't have policy that ensures the bare minimum, the renters get the bad rap when really it is a function of the fact that, like you just mentioned, you know, sometimes I too like to play devil's advocate with landlords because as a planner, I've seen how hard it is for landlords to sometimes, not every landlord is a millionaire. You know, they can't always afford these extensive repairs that come with owning housing. And when you especially look at the situation like one we have in Detroit, where many of these landlords, you know, essentially inherited substandard housing in real estate, they can only afford to pour so much of the little bit of rent that they're getting from the tenants here back into repairs, you know, without making any profit whatsoever. And we don't have a system in Michigan that helps to subsidize those costs. So the landlords, if they don't have to make certain repairs, if they're not mandated to, most times they won't. But the reality is that's every system, right? If there is not a law telling someone that they're not allowed to like steal from a store, are they, you know, they're going to probably steal from the store because there's nothing.
Right, because, you know, if you don't have to do it, it's not something that you're going to go out of your way to do.
To do, yes. And that's the idea, you know, that's the idea that real estate developers take, you know, which gives them a bad rap. But again, you know, the job is not of the real estate developer to be this all, you know, mighty God who provides benefits to the community. It is the job of the municipality, the people that we elect, the people that we put in charge of our communities to develop policies that make it so that the real estate developers have to meet these bare minimums to ensure that we don't have to live in substandard conditions as a result of their presence. And if there is a need to subsidize those things, then we need to be more willing to have those conversations as well. But, you know, I think that we're starting to get there, but, you know, we have such a long way to go in so many of our communities.
Right, right. And you know what? We're getting a ton of, you know, comments and things from the audience out there watching live on Facebook. And, you know, people are making comments about, you know, just mixed use development and how utilizing it in impoverished areas can really help create that prosperity and wealth, and particularly in African-American communities. Got a comment also about there must be a criteria for maintenance of the properties, and, you know, goes both ways for renters and landlords. And, you know, that's the thing, you know, you should want to do well when you're in somebody else's house. If anything, you're going to do better in that house than, say, people who live down the street from me who own this house. And, you know, it's just honestly, they have sheets hanging from the windows. And oh, yeah. It's, you know, so it really is important to make sure that there are standards. And, you know, someone else commented saying that, you know, renters and landlords have to be held accountable. And so I kind of want to shift into a little bit more about your work with Mobilize Detroit and, you know, the election and what you had hoped to achieve getting involved with this organization, and you're wearing your activist hat. And what impact do you think the organization and your work had on the Democratic turnout for the 2020 presidential election?
Yeah, so Mobilize Detroit was like this pet project that I started this year. It was sort of like years in the making. The idea was, so myself and a friend of mine, Paris, we had the idea when we were working at the city of Detroit years ago, we were like, okay, you know, we want to make it so that more voters are showing up to the polls. You know, we want to make it so that we can create more voter access. I mean, we got really inspired with this idea. Then of course, what happens when you have great ideas with your friends, you guys end up taking different turns in life. And then sometimes shelving those things, not to say you're never going to come back to it, but maybe, you know, the timing wasn't exactly right then. Well, this year with the, you know, with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, you know, and so many of other victims of police brutality. And then we had, you know, the Trump presidency, which was hopefully, you know, in our eyes coming to a close, and we're glad that it did. There were so many things just all at stake on this ballot. You know, I think we've talked about Proposal N, which I was like very, very against, you know, this year, and so many things that we felt very strongly about. And we were just sitting and talking one day, and we said, you know what, like if no one is out here, you know, talking to people about, you know, what to do about our responsibility that we have in this election, you know, we were afraid that people were going to sit at home again. And having experienced 2016 and having watched people have so much apathy, you know, I think the election of Trump was sort of twofold. Yes, it was racist America, but there was also this like pervasive apathy, especially with Black people, that like, you know, we're not going to vote for this whole lesser of two evils thing. And we saw this narrative starting to permeate the discussion around Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And I think me and Paris both felt, you know, sort of a responsibility, you know, to start changing the narrative specifically in Detroit. So
if I could interject for half a second, I think that, you know, part of this whole, I think we were so polarized because, you know, you always have this progressive and then, you know, conservative pendulum swing where things go back and forth. But I think it was very extreme because what's happening is you'll have like, and particularly in 2016, you'll have, you know, a lot of Democrats and progressives who do not embrace the feelings and the sentiments of the party currently. They want to try to court other, you know, more conservative leaning people or moderates, as opposed to recognizing that your party has changed and your party's values have changed. Yeah. And therefore you're out of step by picking people like Hillary Clinton, picking people like Joe Biden. And, you know, instead of picking people that you actually, most Democrats wanted Bernie Sanders, they wanted an Elizabeth Warren, they wanted some of those more radical candidates. And I think that, you know, Trump kind of came and he played into voices that are beginning to feel marginalized. And, you know, whether that's the reality or not, a lot of people are beginning to feel left behind by the system. And they feel that, you know, Trump was actually listening and Trump was actually going to make a difference for them. And this is something that he played into, you know, really well. And I think, you know, that was something that if there were any other candidates, I think we would have had a lot more of this excitement, you know, but, you know, and I think, you know, with 2020 and 2016, you know, you just kind of see that America is being, I think the American voters are not necessarily being heard on either side by, you know, the people who are running to elect them or are running to fight for them. You know, you're not actually getting anybody who's actually really listening to what's happening in America right now.
Yeah. And I mean, I would absolutely, you know, agree with that. And I mean, and even to add on to that, you know, we're looking at like Biden's cabinet picks, you know, and I've been sort of like trying to stay out of the news, you know, with this whole social media break that I've been taking, but like, I've heard Jennifer Granholm's name and a few others. And it's just like, you know, are we still going for like the same old, you know, politicians, run of the mill politicians that have been a part, you know, of these cabinet picks? And, you know, why are we not looking at more progressive leadership in these roles? And I think to your point, Ernestine, about the fact that we wanted a Bernie Sanders, we wanted Elizabeth Warren, and you know that about a large part of your Democratic base, yet, you know, the appointees that you're selecting don't quite reflect what you guys know to be true.
They're very mainstream, and they're not necessarily going to fight for the Democratic, you know, things that I want. They're not going to fight for, you know, sustainability and racial justice. They're not, they're just going to be establishment, and they're probably going to be in the pockets of corporations. And, you know, they're not going to fight for that kind of regulation that, you know, in a Bernie Sanders and AOC, you know, Rashida Tlaib or Jennifer, not Jennifer Granholm, but, you know, even Gretchen Whitmer Whitmer. I was really surprised that there was no Gretchen Whitmer on any of these lists, but, you know, I guess.
But again, you know, not picking Whitmer because perhaps she would alienate those, you know, those voters that, you know, voted for Trump last time that came.
But
this
that's
way.
The problem. It's just like, you if know, you're going to be this party, you don't worry about who you're going to alienate. You just fight for right. Who you are there to support, who you're fighting for and who is your base.
Yeah. And it's like the apathy that I just talked about. I feel like in a lot of ways, exactly what you're talking about is what feeds so much of the apathy, because when we were out talking to voters, you know, this fall and out on the ground and at the bus stops, the number one thing we heard was like, don't come over here telling me to vote for Joe Biden. Like, I don't want to hear that. Like, Joe Biden has not spoken to me. You know, none of his policies have spoken to me. Democrats don't speak to us. They don't represent us. They don't care about us. And having to fight back against one, it's like, I can't, you know, we could not even allow ourselves to think that it was our responsibility to fight, you know, the Democrats fight, right, to get, you know, Black voters to vote for Joe Biden. But going up against that narrative was made that much tougher, you know, by leaders that, you know, do not accept the fact that the party is getting more progressive and don't adopt these ideals. Because undoubtedly, if we had a party that was just as stringent about doing the right thing, just as stringent about standing up for the marginalized and making sure that our communities are safe and we have a high quality of living, if they were just as stringent about that as the Republicans are about being racist and about making sure their rich friends stay rich, if they were just as vehement about that, we might have a lot less apathy to battle with when it comes to getting support, especially from these marginalized groups that they look for every year. So absolutely, you know, I could not agree more with that notion.
Thank you for that. And I'm, you know, I think it's just like, you know, even now you see that I think that the part, like both parties and, you know, particularly turning towards the Republicans for a minute here, it's just surprising as we kind of shift into one of my last questions, you know, with I want to hear your thoughts on, you know, the whole stimulus bill and Mitch McConnell blocking things, because the leader of your party, no matter, even though Trump lost, you know, he is still the leader of the Republican Party. He's still going to be seen as the symbol, you know, for Republicans of, you know, you are the voice of the party. And, you know, for them to not listen to him. And, you know, I'm just like, well, what is really going on here? And this is something that, you know, I was a 2020 fellow in the Michigan Political Leadership Program, or MPLP, this year. And, you know, they pair us with, you know, Republicans and Democrats across the aisle, independents, men, women, you know, all across the racial spectrums. So they want you to learn from each other. And a lot of my Republican friends that I've ended up, you know, meeting in this program, they're just like, you know, in some ways, you know, young Republicans are seeing a disconnect between, you know, just like the party and, you know, really what's going on. And like, there's this evolution. And, you know, I think that the powers that be, and I think this kind of, you know, speaks to a lot of what you're hearing about, like somebody made a post on Facebook or social media and was talking about the ages of Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi and how, you know, you have, you know, these older leaders who are, you know, slightly out of touch with, you know, what's actually going on in their party today. And, you know, I think this is something that, you know, it's just kind of nuts. It's like, why don't you see that this is going to be something that's going to benefit everyone? Instead, you're just like, well, people are going to get lazy. They don't want to work. Nobody wants to not work. You know, if it weren't a pandemic, then everybody would be wanting to go out there and be self-actualized and be a person who's contributing to society. I refuse to believe, you know, no matter what, that somebody is just going to be like, all right, I'd actually rather take handouts. And so, you know, I don't know why that is the mentality behind not wanting to help Americans.
Yeah. And in addition to that, something that I read, which was interesting, was that, oh, the money isn't, you know, well targeted enough, because they felt as if, you know, the $2,000 for every single household was too widespread. And I think that they are just so problematic with their thinking, right? Because like so many of the other, you know, types of support that was put out there, you know, coronavirus aid packages that we got, so many of them were restrictive. I mean, we look at like the small business protection program, like I forget, it was like the with the SBA, the SBA small business loans, and like mostly like companies like Ruth Chris and Applebee's, you know, they were getting all of these like small business loans, and then the money ran out super, super fast because you had all these chains, you know, that picked up most of the money and to the tune of millions of dollars, you know, from these aid packages, while with real small businesses that had a very hard time surviving this year got nothing. And, you know, instead of looking at programs like that, and targeting those funds better, you're worried about not giving, you know, $2,000 to every single American, when the reality is what we know is you put restrictions on it and you're gonna end up, it's like that thing, like, you know, where they say, you know, if you put too many rules, you end up actually putting certain people who may need the support at a disadvantage from getting it, right? Like if you put all of this red tape in place, you know, if you make people have to read, you know, something and understand another thing and take step after step after step just to get this support, well, chances are they're going to fall off the wagon and eventually never get there, you know, because it's just too hard. And when you're already right. small, when getting, you know, when surviving the day to day of being a small business owner is already hard enough, who wants to also have the battle of trying to fight for money that, you know, they're probably not gonna, you know, get anyway. And so, you know, I think that our Republican senators are incredibly selfish, you know, but what really angered me more than anything was watching Trump, you know, not sign this bill and try to take credit as if he were doing a noble thing by requesting that they rewrite this, you know, $2,000, you know, per head into the bill. And what infuriated me about that was, one, you know, Trump was involved in the negotiations of this bill. His Treasury Secretary was involved up until, I think, they just a few days before. And I think he had made some comments on one of the news stations, maybe CNBC, you know, positive comments about the bill and how excited they were to get it passed. And Trump at the last minute, he pulls a switcheroo, you know, and it says, no, you know, $2,000 per American. And the fact that you see folks who, you know, are saying, because I talk to my neighbors and people who are saying, yeah, well, you see, Trump is going to stop it. And, you know, he wants us to get $2,000. And it's like the genius that he is to say that that's why he's stopping it. When we know, you know, the reality is Trump is angry that we did not reelect him. You know, he is the tyrant in chief, and he is angry that he will be unseated in 20 or so days. And he wants us to suffer. And so every move he makes, you know, up until he leaves office is because he wants us to suffer in some way for not reelecting him, while also taking credit for anything good that happens. And I think to throw that kind of wrench in at the last minute and essentially stop, you know, so many Americans who needed unemployment support this week from being able to collect that support. I mean, to my knowledge, unemployment is not even letting people file this week. And I could be
right. And I've been hearing about all sorts of problems with the website, and people spend hours, you know, and this has been all pandemic long. So now we're heading back up to March, and this has been, you know, people's realities for, you know, an entire year.
Yeah. And it angers me how manipulative this president continues to be, and how, you know, he does not care, you know, about how much it impacts us. You know, he was vacationing, I think they said, when he finally signed the bill. And it's like, oh, lucky you getting the vacation, while so many Americans have to turn around next week and try to find out if their unemployment assistance is still going to be there, you know. And it's just so, so, so infuriating. I cannot wait, you know, for Biden and Kamala to take back, you know, our White House and hopefully, you know, put forth some policies that are going to make people feel even more compelled, you know, to keep Democrats in the White House, you know, the 4 years thereafter. I'm crossing my fingers, you know, that Biden and Kamala, you know, make some real good change. I keep saying, you know, if Trump spent the last 4 years, you know, packing his Supreme Court and getting all the support that he needed to vehemently push the things he wanted done, we need Democrats in office who will be just as hard about the right things. So, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what the Biden presidency does.
That's true. And, you know, that remains to be seen. And like I said, you know, to me, it's just not going to be enough, because this was the party that kind of just, like, they're way too centrist. But at the same time, you know, that is completely understandable. And, you know, so hopefully things do go well. But also, I think this all hinges on the Georgia runoff election. So,
oh, yeah.
That sure. really is going to determine, you know, what really happens over the next 4 years. So, you know, and that's sad in itself because of the fact that, one, just looking at how these Georgia runoff elections actually do and what they, you know, it's just, you're not even sure if you're going to necessarily get fairness. But two, it's like that we've become so polarized. And if you think back, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, maybe even 50 years ago, you had a lot less of this. Oh, this party is just going to, we're all going to vote together, as opposed to the principle of a bill, the principle of legislation. And yeah. I agree with this and I'm going to work across the aisle. So there is no such thing as working yeah. across the aisle anymore. And yeah. you know, so we're definitely going to be in for some challenges and some things to watch for. But yeah. you know, I really want to thank you for coming on Quick to Politic and being part of such a lively discussion. And you know, I don't know what it is about like the holidays. I've been eating the wrong things and my mood has just been like, I think I'm just overdoing everything. So this is just so happy. It was so happy to talk to you. And it was just lifted my spirits. And, you know, of course, having a good political discussion and talking about urban planning development and, you know, activism, you know, of course, that's going to get me all energized. So thank you for lifting my day. And, you know, we got so many good comments out here. And I think, so we even have one from Harrisana Richards says, in addition to Trump, the shift we're experiencing significantly impacted by transitioning from democratic leaders that have unfortunately been complicit in the systems that are problematic currently. So she says, you're right, Wendy, we have to struggle to establish true progressive leadership. And I think that goes across the board for even, you know, my conservative colleagues and friends and neighbors. Yeah. So we really have to do better. And I think maybe it's up to us as millennials, maybe. But I think also, you know, the funny thing is because you have, you know, so many members of the greatest generation or the silent generation who are still in political party leadership, it's not even like the time of the people who should be making the decisions, which would be like Generation X, people born from like 1965 down to, you know, about 1980. They're not even the ones who are making the decisions in the rooms right now, when really it should be, you know, them making the decisions, and, you know, baby boomers kind of like also having contributing, you know. So it's really, really time to assess, you know, where our true values lie as a country. And, you know, so thanks for having this discussion with me. And this isn't going to be the last, because we can talk for hours about all this stuff.
Oh my goodness. I was just going to say, Ernestine, I could go on for days with you. Like, you know me by now, you know how passionate I could get. I know you probably like were like, Wendy, come off the rails at certain points.
Not at all. No. You need that fire. You need that inspiration and that kind of energy and the hunger and the determination to really stand up for what we believe in, because I think too much in just politics, you get a lot of people who, you know, will not stand up for things. They'll just go along with the flow. And I think that's maybe what's happened. You know, I don't know, like I remember my history teacher, Mr. Wayberg, at Harper Woods High. Shout out to Mr. Wayberg if you're watching. But he showed us Mr. Smith Goes to Washington because he wanted to remind us how fired up we should be about politics. And it is a classic film about, you know, somebody who was not necessarily a politician, you know, but really wanted to be able to advocate and fight for people and fight for the little voices and to stand up for things that we should be thinking, you know, more big picture on. So,
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I know you asked me at the top of the podcast where folks can find me. I am Wendy Caldwell Liddell on Facebook. My Instagram, my Instagram is Wendy M. Liddell. I'm not on social media right now. I'm still taking a break. I have no clue when I'm coming back, but you can also Mobilize 313 is the Facebook group. We will be coming back. Mobilize 313 will be back supporting local elections next year. I have my business brand, Wendy at D-Source, which is also on Instagram. You can find Mobilize Detroit on Instagram. Use all those channels to find me. And when I am back, I have so many amazing updates to share. I'm so excited.
Oh my gosh. I love this excited energy. Like, all right. Well, thank you. Thank you.
myself, I say just relax, you know, stay with your family now, keep your head clear. And when the holidays are done, when I'm done recuperating, I'm back at it and I'm rolling. So I'm excited to come back when I do.
Okay, well, with that, thank you out there for watching on the Facebook. I'm going to end the live. Thanks, guys. And for all of you out there watching on YouTube, thank you. Remember to like, comment, and subscribe. And thank you so much to Wendy for joining us. Thank you.